Well, the osprey. To be in the presence of another man's demon and away from his own, affected Lee with a powerful throb of guilt and strange pleasure. They were gliding, as if he too were a bird, on the turbulent updrafts above the forest, and Lee looked around through the dark air, now suffused with a pallid glow from the full moon that occasionally glared through a brief rent in the cloud cover and made the treetops ring with silver. The eagle demon uttered a harsh scream, and from below came in 1,000 different voices the calls of 1,000 birds. The too-woo of owls, the alarm shriek of little sparrows, the liquid music of the nightingale. Sayan Kutur was calling them. And in answer they came, every bird in the forest, whether they had been gliding in the hunt on silent wings or roosting asleep. They came fluttering upwards in their thousands through the tumbling air. And Lee felt whatever bird nature he was sharing respond with joy to the command of the Eagle Queen, and whatever humanness he had left felt the strangest of pleasures, that of offering eager obedience to a stronger power that was wholly right. And he wheeled and turned with the rest of the mighty flock, 100 different species all turning as one in the magnetic will of the eagle, and saw against the silver cloud rack the hateful dark regularity of a zeppelin. They all knew exactly what they must do, and they streamed towards the airship, the swiftest reaching it first, but none so swiftly as Sayan Kutur. The tiny wrens and finches, the darting swifts, the silent-winged owls. Within a minute the craft was laden with them, their claws scrabbling for purchase on the oiled silk or puncturing it to gain a hold. They avoided the engine, though some were drawn into it and dashed to pieces by the slicing propellers. Most of the birds simply perched on the body of the zeppelin, and those that came next seized onto them until they covered not only the whole body of the craft, now venting hydrogen through 1,000 tiny claw holes, but the windows of the cabin, too, and the struts and cables. Every square inch of room had a bird, 2 birds, 3 or more, clinging to it. The pilot was helpless. Under the weight of the birds, the craft began to sink farther and farther down, and then another of those sudden, cruel scarps appeared, shouldering up out of the night and, of course, quite invisible to the men inside the zeppelin, who was swinging their guns wildly and firing at random. At the last moment, Sayan Kutur screamed, and a thunder of wingbeats drowned even the roar of the engine as every bird took off and flew away. And the men in the cabin had 4 or 5 horrified seconds of knowledge before the zeppelin crashed and burst into flames. Fire. Heat. Flames. Lee woke up again, his body as hot as if he'd been lying in the desert sun. Outside the tent there was still the endless drip, drip of wet leaves on the canvas, but the storm was over. Pale grey light seeped in, and Lee propped himself up to find Hester blinking beside him, and the shaman wrapped in a blanket, so deeply asleep he might have been dead, had not Sayan Kutur been perched asleep on a fallen branch outside. The only sound apart from the drip of water was the normal forest bird song. No engines in the sky, no enemy voices, so Lee thought it might be safe to light the fire, and after a struggle he got it going and brewed some coffee.
What now, Hester?
Depends. There was 4 of those zeppelins, and he destroyed 3.
I mean, have we discharged our duty?
She flicked her ears and said,
Don't remember no contract.
It ain't a contractual thing. It's a moral thing.
We got 1 more zeppelin to think about before you start fretting about morals, Lee. There's 30-40 men with guns, all coming for us. Imperial soldiers, what's more. Survival first, morals later.
She was right, of course, and as he sipped the scalding brew and smoked a cigar, with the daylight gradually growing stronger, he wondered what he would do if he were in charge of the 1 remaining zeppelin. Withdraw and wait for full daylight, no doubt, and fly high enough to scan the edge of the forest over a wide area, so he could see when Lee and Grumman broke cover. The osprey demon Sayan Kutur awoke and stretched her great wings above where Lee was sitting. Hester looked up and turned her head this way and that, looking at the mighty demon with each golden eye in turn, and a moment later the shaman himself came out of the tent.
Busy night.
A busy day to come. We must leave the forest at once, Mr. Scoresby. They are going to burn it.
Lee looked around incredulously at the soaking vegetation and said,
How?
They have an engine that throws out a kind of naphtha blended with potash, which ignites when it touches water. The Imperial Navy developed it to use in their war with Nippon. If the forest is saturated, it will catch all the more quickly.
You can see that, can you?
As clearly as you saw what happened to the zeppelins during the night. Pack what you want to carry, and come away now.
Lee rubbed his jaw. The most valuable things he owned were also the most portable, namely the instruments from the balloon. So he retrieved them from the basket, stowed them carefully in a knapsack, and made sure his rifle was loaded and dry. He left the basket, the rigging, and the gas bag where they lay, tangled and twisted among the branches. From now on he was an aeronaut no more, unless by some miracle he escaped with his life and found enough money to buy another balloon. Now he had to move like an insect along the surface of the earth. They smelled the smoke before they heard the flames, because a breeze from the sea was lifting it inland. By the time they reached the edge of the trees, they could hear the fire, a deep and greedy roar.
Why didn't they do this last night? They could have barbecued us in our sleep.
I guess they want to catch us alive,
Grumman replied, stripping a branch of its leaves so he could use it as a walking stick.
And they're waiting to see where we leave the forest.
And sure enough, the drone of the Zeppelin soon became audible, even over the sound of the flames and of their own labored breathing. For they were hurrying now, clambering upwards over roots and rocks and fallen tree trunks, and stopping only to gather breath. Sayan Kateur, flying high, swooped down to tell them how much progress they were making and how far behind the flames were, though it wasn't long before they could see smoke above the trees behind them, and then a streaming banner of flame. Creatures of the forest, squirrels, birds, wild boar, were fleeing with them, and a chorus of squealings, shriekings, alarm calls of every sort rose around them. The two travelers struggled on towards the edge of the tree line, which was not far ahead, and then they reached it as wave after wave of heat rolled up at them from the roaring billows of flame that now soared 50 feet into the air. Trees blazed like torches. The sap in their veins boiled and split them asunder. The pitch in the conifers caught like naphtha. The twigs seemed to blossom with ferocious orange flowers all in a moment. Gasping, Lee and Grumman forced themselves up the steep slope of rocks and scree. Half the sky was obscured by smoke and heat shimmer, but high above there floated the squat shape of the one remaining Zeppelin. Too far away, Lee thought hopefully, to see them, even through binoculars. The mountainside rose sheer and impassable ahead of them. There was only one route out of the trap they were in, and that was a narrow defile ahead, where a dry riverbed emerged from a fold in the cliffs. Lee pointed, and Grumman said,
"My thoughts exactly, Mr. Scoresby."
His demon, gliding and circling above, tipped her wings and sped to the ravine on a billowing updraft. The men didn't pause, climbing on as quickly as they could. But Lee said,
"Excuse me for asking this if it's impertinent, but I never knew anyone whose demon could do that except witches. But you're no witch. Was that something you learned to do, or did it come natural?"
"For a human being, nothing comes naturally. We have to learn everything we do. Sayan Kateur is telling me that the ravine leads to a pass. If we get there before they see us, we could escape yet."
The eagle swooped down again, and the men climbed higher. Hester preferred to find her own way over the rocks, so Lee followed where she led, avoiding the loose stones and moving as swiftly as he could over the larger rocks, making all the time for the little gulch. Lee was anxious about Grumman, because the other man was pale and drawn and breathing hard. His labors in the night had drained a lot of his energy. How far they could keep going was a question Lee didn't want to face, but when they were nearly at the entrance to the ravine, and actually on the edge of the dried riverbed, he heard a change in the sound of the Zeppelin.
"They've seen us."
And it was like receiving a sentence of death. Hester stumbled. Even sure-footed, firm-hearted Hester stumbled and faltered. Grumman leaned on the stick he carried and shaded his eyes to look back, and Lee turned to look too. The Zeppelin was descending fast, making for the slope directly below them. It was clear that the pursuers intended to capture them, not kill them, for a burst of gunfire just then would have finished both of them in a second. Instead, the pilot brought the airship skillfully to a hover just above the ground, at the highest point in the slope where he safely could, and from the cabin door a stream of blue-uniformed men jumped down, their wolf demons beside them, and began to climb. Lee and Grumman were 600 yards above them, and not far from the entrance to the ravine. Once they reached it, they could hold the soldiers off as long as their ammunition held out. But they had only one rifle.
"They're after me, Mr. Scoresby, not you. If you give me the rifle and surrender yourself, you'll survive. They're disciplined troops. You'll be a prisoner of war."
Lee ignored that and said,
"Get moving. Make the gulch and I'll hold them off from the mouth while you find your way out the other end. I brought you this far, and I ain't going to sit back and let him catch you now."
The men below were moving up quickly, for they were fit and rested. Grumman nodded.
"I had no strength left to bring the fourth one down,"
was all he said, and they moved quickly into the shelter of the gulch.
"Just tell me before you go, because I won't be easy till I know. What side I'm fighting for, I can't tell, and I don't greatly care. Just tell me this. What I'm a-going to do now, is that going to help that little girl, Lyra, or harm her?"
"It's going to help her."
"And your oath?" You won't forget what you swore to me.
I won't forget.
Because Dr. Grumman, or John Parry, or whatever name you take up in whatever world you end up in, you be aware of this. I love that little child like a daughter. If I'd had a child of my own, I couldn't love her more. And if you break that oath, whatever remains of me will pursue whatever remains of you, and you'll spend the rest of eternity wishing you never existed. That's how important that oath is.
I understand. And you have my word.
Then that's all I need to know. Go well.
The shaman held out his hand, and Lee shook it. Then Grumman turned and made his way up the gulch, and Lee looked around for the best place to make his stand.
Not the big boulder, Lee. You can't see to the right from there, and they could rush us. Take the smaller one.
There was a roaring in Lee's ears that had nothing to do with the conflagration in the forest below, or with the laboring drone of the Zeppelin trying to rise again. It had to do with his childhood and the Alamo. How often he and his companions had played that heroic battle in the ruins of the old fort, taking turns to be Danes and French. His childhood was coming back to him with a vengeance. He took out the Navajo ring of his mother's and laid it on the rock beside him. In the old Alamo games, Hester had often been a cougar or a wolf, and once or twice a rattlesnake, but mostly a mockingbird. Now...
Quit daydreaming and take a sight. This ain't play, Lee.
The men climbing the slope had fanned out and were moving more slowly because they saw the problem as well as he did. They knew they'd have to capture the gulch, and they knew that one man with a rifle could hold them off for a long time. Behind them, to Lee's surprise, the Zeppelin was still laboring to rise. Maybe its buoyancy was going, or maybe the fuel was running low, but either way it hadn't taken off yet, and it gave him an idea. He adjusted his position and sighted along the old Winchester until he had the port engine mounting plumb in view and fired. The crack raised the soldiers' heads as they climbed towards him, but a second later the engine suddenly roared and then just as suddenly seized and died. The Zeppelin lurched over to one side. Lee could hear the other engine howling, but the airship was grounded now. The soldiers had halted and taken cover as well as they could. Lee could count them, and he did. 25. He had 30 bullets. Hester crept up close to his left shoulder.
I'll watch this way.
Crouched on the grey boulder, her ears flat along her back, she looked like a little stone herself, grey-brown and inconspicuous except for her eyes. Hester was no beauty. She was about as plain and scrawny as her hair could be, but her eyes were marvellously coloured, gold-hazel flecked with rays of deepest peat-brown and forest-green. And now those eyes were looking down at the last landscape they'd ever see, a barren slope of brutal, tumbled rocks, and beyond it a forest on fire. Not a blade of grass, not a speck of green to rest on. Her ears flicked slightly.
They're talking. I can hear, but I can't understand.
Russian. They're going to come up all together and not a run. That would be hardest for us, so they'll do that.
Aim straight.
I will. But hell, I don't like taking lives, Hester.
Ours or theirs?
No, it's more than that. It's theirs or Lyra's. I can't see how, but we're connected to that child, and I'm glad of it.
There's a man on the left about to shoot,
said Hester, and as she spoke, a crack came from his rifle and chips of stone flew off the boulder a foot from where she crouched. The bullet whined off into the gulch, but she didn't move a muscle.
Well, that makes me feel better about doing this,
said Lee, and took careful aim. He fired. There was only a small patch of blue to aim at, but he hit it. With a surprised cry, the man fell back and died. And then the fight began. Within a minute, the crack of rifles, the whine of ricocheting bullets, the smash of pulverizing rock echoed and rang the length of the mountainside and along the hollow gulch behind. The smell of cordite and the burning smell that came from the powdered rock where the bullets hit were just variations on the smell of burning wood from the forest, until it seemed that the whole world was burning. Lee's boulder was soon scarred and pitted, and he felt the thud of the bullets as they hit it. Once he saw the fur on Hester's back ripple as the wind of a bullet passed over it, but she didn't budge, nor did he stop firing. That first minute was fierce, and after it, in the pause that came, Lee found that he was wounded. There was blood on the rock under his cheek, and his right hand and the rifle bolt were red. Hester moved around to look.
Nothing big. A bullet clipped your scalp.
Did you count how many fell, Hester?
No. Too busy ducking. Reload while you can, boy.
He rolled down behind the rock and worked the bolt back and forth. It was hot, and the blood that had flowed freely over it from the scalp wound was drying and making the mechanism stiff. He spat on it carefully and it loosened. Then he hauled himself back into position, and even before he'd set his eye to the sight, he took a bullet. It felt like an explosion in his left shoulder. For a few seconds he was dazed, and then he came to his senses with his left arm numb and useless. There was a great deal of pain waiting to spring on him, but it hadn't raised the courage yet, and that thought gave him the strength to focus his mind on shooting again. He propped the rifle on the dead and useless arm that had been so full of life a minute ago, and sighted with stolid concentration. One shot. Two. Three. And each found its man.
How are we doing?
Good shooting,
she whispered back, very close to his cheek.
Don't stop. Over by that black boulder.
He looked, aimed, shot. The figure fell.
Damn, these are men like me.
Makes no sense. Do it anyway.
Do you believe him, Grumman?
Sure. Plumb ahead, Lee.
Crack. Another man fell and his demon went out like a candle. Then there was a long silence. Lee fumbled in his pocket and found some more bullets. As he reloaded, he felt something so rare his heart nearly failed. He felt Hester's face pressed to his own, and it was wet with tears.
Lee, this is my fault.
Why?
The Skraeling. I told you to take his ring. Without that, we'd never be in this trouble.
You think I ever did what you told me? I took it because the witch...
He didn't finish because another bullet found him. This time it smashed into his left leg, and before he could even blink, a third one clipped his head again like a red-hot poker laid along his skull.
Not long now, Hester,
he muttered, trying to hold still.
The witch, Lee. You said the witch. Remember?
Poor Hester, she was lying now, not crouching, tense and watchful as she'd done all his adult life, and her beautiful gold-brown eyes were growing dull.
Still beautiful. Oh, Hester, yeah, the witch. She gave me...
Sure she did. The flower.
In my breast pocket. Fetch it, Hester, I can't move.
It was a hard struggle, but she tugged out the little scarlet flower with her strong teeth and laid it by his right hand. With a great effort, he closed it in his fist and said,
Serafina Pecola, help me. I beg...
A movement below. He let go of the flower, sighted, fired. The movement died. Hester was failing.
Hester, don't you go before I do.
Lee, I couldn't abide to be anywhere away from you for a single second.
You think the witch will come?
Sure she will. We should have called her before.
We should have done a lot of things.
Maybe so.
Another crack, and this time the bullet went deep somewhere inside, seeking out the center of his life. He thought, it won't find it there. Hester's my center. And he saw a blue flicker down below and strained to bring the barrel over to it.
He's the one.
Lee found it hard to pull the trigger. Everything was hard. He had to try three times, and finally he got it. The blue uniform tumbled away down the slope. Another long silence. The pain nearby was losing its fear of him. It was like a pack of jackals, circling, sniffing, treading closer, and he knew they wouldn't leave him now till they'd eaten him bare.
There's one man left. He's a-makin' for the Zeppelin.
And Lee saw him mistily, one soldier of the Imperial Guard creeping away from his company's defeat.
I can't shoot a man in the back.
Shame to die with one bullet left, though.
So he took aim with his last bullet at the Zeppelin itself, still roaring and straining to rise with its one engine, and the bullet must have been red-hot, or maybe a burning brand from the forest below was wafted to the airship on an updraft, for the gas suddenly billowed into an orange fireball, and the envelope and the metal skeleton rose a little way and then tumbled down very slowly, gently, but full of a fiery death. And the man creeping away, and the six or seven others who were the only remnant of the guard, and who hadn't dared come closer to the man holding the ravine, were engulfed by the fire that fell on them. Lee saw the fireball and heard through the roar in his ears Hester saying,
"That's all of them, Lee,"
he said, or thought.
"Those poor men didn't have to come to this, nor did we."
"We held them off. We held out. We're helping Lyra."
Then she was pressing her little, proud, broken self against his face, as close as she could get. And then they died. Chapter 15. Blood Moss. On, said the alethiometer. Farther. Higher. So on they climbed. The witches flew above to spy out the best routes, because the hilly land soon gave way to steeper slopes and rocky footing, and as the sun rose towards noon, the travellers found themselves in a tangled land of dry gullies, cliffs, and boulder-strewn valleys where not a single green leaf grew, and where the stridulation of insects was the only sound. They moved on, stopping only for sips of water from their goatskin flasks, and talking little. Pantalaimon flew above Lyra's head for a while until he tired of that, and then he became a little sure-footed mountain sheep, vain of his horns, leaping among rocks while Lyra scrambled laboriously alongside. Will moved on grimly, screwing up his eyes against the glare, ignoring the worsening pain from his hand, and finally reaching a state in which movement alone was good and stillness bad, so that he suffered more from resting than from toiling on. And since the failure of the witch's spell to stop his bleeding, he thought they were regarding him with fear, too, as if he was marked by some curse greater than their own powers. At one point they came to a little lake, a patch of intense blue scarcely 30 yards across among the red rocks. They stopped there to drink and refill their flasks, and to soak their aching feet in the icy water. They stayed a few minutes and moved on, and soon afterwards, when the sun was at its highest and hottest, Seraphina Pecola darted down to speak to them. She was agitated.
I must leave you for a while. Lee Scoresby needs me. I don't know why, but he wouldn't call if he didn't need my help. Keep going, and I'll find you.
Mr. Scoresby? But where...
But Seraphina was gone, speeding out of sight before Lyra could finish the question. Lyra reached automatically for the alethiometer to ask what had happened to Lee Scoresby, but she let her hand drop, because she'd promised to do no more than guide Will. She looked across to him. He was sitting nearby, his hand held loosely on his knee and still slowly dripping blood, his face scorched by the sun and pale under the burning.
Will, do you know why you have to find your father?
It's what I've always known. My mother said I'd take up my father's mantle, that's all I know.
What does that mean, taking up his mantle? What's a mantle?
A task, I suppose. Whatever he's been doing, I've got to carry on. Makes as much sense as anything else.
He wiped the sweat out of his eyes with his right hand. What he couldn't say was that he longed for his father as a lost child yearns for home. That comparison wouldn't have occurred to him, because home was the place he kept safe for his mother, not the place others kept safe for him. But it had been 5 years now since that Saturday morning in the supermarket, when the pretend game of hiding from the enemies became desperately real. Such a long time in his life, and his heart craved to hear the words, "Well done. Well done, my child. No one on earth could have done better. I'm proud of you. Come and rest now." Will longed for that so much that he hardly knew he did. It was just part of what everything felt like. So he couldn't express that to Lyra now, though she could see it in his eyes, and that was new for her, too, to be quite so perceptive. The fact was that where Will was concerned, she was developing a new kind of sense, as if he were simply more in focus than anyone she'd known before. Everything about him was clear and close and immediate. And she might have said that to him, but at that moment a witch flew down.
I can see people behind us. They're a long way back, but they're moving quickly. Shall I go closer and look?
Yes, do. But fly low and hide, and don't let them see you.
Will and Lyra got painfully to their feet again and clambered on.
I've been cold plenty of times,
Lyra said, to take her mind off the pursuers.
But I ain't been this hot ever. Is it this hot in your world?
Not where I used to live. Not normally. But the climate's been changing. The summers are hotter than they used to be. They say that people have been interfering with the atmosphere by putting chemicals in it, and the weather's going out of control.
Yeah, well, they have, and it is. And we're here in the middle of it.
He was too hot and thirsty to reply, and they climbed on breathlessly in the throbbing air. Pantalaimon was a cricket now and sat on Lyra's shoulder, too tired to leap or fly. From time to time the witches would see a spring high up, too high to climb to, and fly up to fill the children's flasks. They would soon have died without water, and there was none where they were. Any spring that made its way into the air was soon swallowed again among the rocks, and so they moved on towards evening. The witch who flew back to spy was called Lena Felt. She flew low from crag to crag, and as the sun was setting and drawing a wild blood red out of the rocks, she came to the little blue lake and found a troop of soldiers making camp. But her first glimpse of them told her more than she wanted to know. These soldiers had no demons. And they weren't from Will's world, or the world of Chitagatse, where people's demons were inside them and where they still looked alive. These men were from her own world, and to see them without demons was a gross and sickening horror. Then, out of a tent by the lakeside, came the explanation. Lena Felt saw a woman, a short life, graceful in her khaki hunting clothes and as full of life as the golden monkey who capered along the water's edge beside her. Lena Felt hid among the rocks above and watched as Mrs. Coulter spoke to the officer in charge and as his men put up tents, made fires, boiled water. The witch had been among Serafina Pekala's troop who rescued the children at Bolvanger, and she longed to shoot Mrs. Coulter on the spot. But some fortune was protecting the woman, for it was just too far for a bow shot from where she was, and the witch could get no closer without making herself invisible. So she began to make the spell. It took 10 minutes of deep concentration. Confident at last, Lena Felt went down the rocky slope towards the lake, and as she walked through the camp, one or two blank-eyed soldiers glanced up briefly, but found what they saw too hard to remember, and looked away again. The witch stopped outside the tent Mrs. Coulter had gone into, and fitted an arrow to her bowstring. She listened to the low voice through the canvas, and then moved carefully to the open flap that overlooked the lake. Inside the tent, Mrs. Coulter was talking to a man Lena Felt hadn't seen before. An older man, grey-haired and powerful, with a serpent demon twined around his wrist. He was sitting in a canvas chair beside hers, and she was leaning towards him, speaking softly.
Of course, Carlyle. I'll tell you anything you like. What do you want to know?
How do you command the spectres? I didn't think it possible, but you have them following you like dogs. Are they afraid of your bodyguard? What is it?
Simple. They know I can give them more nourishment if they let me live than if they consume me. I can lead them to all the victims their phantom hearts desire. As soon as you described them to me, I knew I could dominate them. And so it turns out. And a whole world trembles in the power of these pallid things. But, Carlyle, I can please you too, you know. Would you like me to please you even more?
Marisa, it's enough of a pleasure to be close to you.
No, it isn't, Carlyle. You know it isn't. You know I can please you more than this.
Her demon's little black horny hands were stroking the serpent demon. Little by little, the serpent loosened herself and began to flow along the man's arm towards the monkey. Both the man and the woman were holding glasses of golden wine, and she sipped hers and leaned a little closer to him. Said the man as the demon slipped slowly off his arm and let her weight into the golden monkey's hands. The monkey raised her slowly to his face and ran his cheek softly along her emerald skin. Her tongue flicked blackly this way and that, and the man sighed.
Carlo, tell me why you're pursuing the boy.
Mrs. Coulter whispered, and her voice was as soft as the monkey's caress.
Why do you need to find him?
He has something I want. Oh, Marisa.
What is it, Carlo? What's he got?
He shook his head, but he was finding it hard to resist. His demon was twined gently around the monkey's breast, and running her head through and through the long, lustrous fur as his hands moved along her fluid length. Lena Felt watched them, standing invisible just 2 paces from where they sat. Her bowstring was taut, the arrow knocked to it in readiness. She could have pulled and loosed in less than a second, and Mrs. Coulter would have been dead before she finished drawing breath. But the witch was curious. She stood still and silent and wide-eyed. But while she was watching Mrs. Coulter, she didn't look behind her across the little blue lake. On the far side of it in the darkness, a grove of ghostly trees seemed to have planted itself, a grove that shivered every so often with a tremor like a conscious intention. But they were not trees, of course. And while all the curiosity of Lena Felt and her demon was directed at Mrs. Coulter, one of the pallid forms detached itself from its fellows and drifted across the surface of the icy water, causing not a single ripple, until it paused a foot from the rock on which Lena Felt's demon was perched.
You could easily tell me, Carlo. You could whisper it. You could pretend to be talking in your sleep, and who could blame you for that? Just tell me what the boy has and why you want it. I could get it for you. Wouldn't you like me to do that?
Just tell me, Carlo. I don't want it. I want the girl. What is it? Just tell me and you shall have it.
He gave a soft shudder. His eyes were closed. Then he said,
It's a knife. The subtle knife of Chitagatse. You haven't heard of it, Marisa. Some people call it Teleutaire Makaira, the last knife of all. Others call it Asaheta.
What does it do, Carlo? Why is it special?
It's the knife that will cut anything. Not even its makers knew what it could do. Nothing, no one, matter, spirit, angel, air. Nothing is invulnerable to the subtle knife. Marisa, it's mine. You understand?
Of course, Carlo, I promise. Let me fill your glass.
And as the golden monkey slowly ran his hands along the emerald serpent again and again, squeezing just a little, lifting, stroking as Sir Charles sighed with pleasure, Lena Felt saw what was truly happening. Because while the man's eyes were closed, Mrs. Coulter secretly tilted a few drops from a small flask into the glass before filling it again with wine.
Here, darling, let's drink. To each other.
He was already intoxicated. He took the glass and sipped greedily, once, again, and again. And then, without any warning, Mrs. Coulter stood up and turned and looked Lena Felt full in the face.
Well, witch, did you think I don't know how you make yourself invisible?
Lena Felt was too surprised to move. Behind her, the man was struggling to breathe. His chest was heaving, his face was red, and his demon was limp and fainting in the monkey's hands. The monkey shook her off in contempt. Lena Felt tried to swing her bow up, but a fatal paralysis had touched her shoulder. She couldn't make herself do it. This had never happened before, and she uttered a little cry.
Oh, it's too late for that. Look at the lake, witch.
Lena Felt turned and saw her snow-bunting demon fluttering and shrieking as if he were in a glass chamber that was being emptied of air, fluttering and falling, slumping, failing, his beak opening wide, gasping in panic. The spectre had enveloped him.
No!
She cried, and tried to move towards it, but was driven back by a spasm of nausea. Even in her sickened distress, Lena Felt could see that Mrs. Coulter had more force in her soul than anyone she had ever seen. It didn't surprise her to see that the spectre was under Mrs. Coulter's power. No one could resist that authority. Lena Felt turned back in anguish to the woman.
Let him go! Please, let him go!
We'll see. Is the child with you, the girl, Lyra?
Yes!
And a boy, too, a boy with a knife?
Yes, I beg you!
And how many witches have you?
20! Let him go, let him go!
All in the air, or do some of you stay on the ground with the children?
Most in the air, 3 or 4 on the ground, always. This is anguish! Let him go, or kill me now!
How far up the mountain are they? Are they moving on, or have they stopped to rest?
Lena Felt told her everything. She could have resisted any torture but what was happening to her demon now. When Mrs. Coulter had learned all she wanted to know about where the witches were, and how they guarded Lyra and Will, she said,
And now tell me this. You witches know something about the child, Lyra. I nearly learned it from one of your sisters, but she died before I could complete the torture. Well, there is no one to save you now. Tell me the truth about my daughter.
She will be the mother. She will be life. Mother... She will disobey. She will...
Name her! You are saying everything, but the most important thing, name her!
Eve! Mother of all! Eve again! Mother Eve!
Said Mrs. Coulter, and she breathed a great sigh as if the purpose of her life was clear to her at last. Dimly the witch saw what she had done, and through the horror that was enveloping her, she tried to cry out,
What will you do to her? What will you do?
Why, I shall have to destroy her, to prevent another fall. Why didn't I see this before? It was too large to see.
She clapped her hands together softly, like a child, wide-eyed. Lena Felt, whimpering, heard her go on.
Of course. Asriel will make war on the Authority, and then... of course. As before, so again. And Lyra is Eve. And this time she will not fall. I'll see to that.
And Mrs. Coulter drew herself up and snapped her fingers to the spectre feeding on the witch's demon. The little snow-bunting demon lay twitching on the rock as the spectre moved towards the witch herself. And then whatever Lena Felt had undergone before was doubled and trebled and multiplied 100-fold. She felt a nausea of the soul, a hideous and sickening despair, a melancholy weariness so profound that she was going to die of it. Her last conscious thought was disgust at life. Her senses had lied to her. The world was not made of energy and delight, but of foulness, betrayal, and lassitude. Living was hateful, and death was no better, and from end to end of the universe this was the first and last and only truth. Thus she stood, bow in hand, indifferent, dead in life. So Lenefeldt failed to see or to care about what Mrs. Coulter did next. Ignoring the grey-haired man slumped unconscious in the canvas chair, and his dull-skinned demon coiled in the dust, the woman called the captain of the soldiers and ordered them to get ready for a night march up the mountain. Then she went to the edge of the water and called to the spectres. They came at her command, gliding like pillars of mist across the water. She raised her arms and made them forget they were earthbound, so that one by one they rose into the air and floated free like malignant thistledown, drifting up into the night, and borne by the air currents towards Will and Lyra and the other witches. But Lenefeldt saw nothing of it. The temperature dropped quickly after dark, and when Will and Lyra had eaten the last of their dry bread, they lay down under an overhanging rock to keep warm and try to sleep. At least Lyra didn't have to try. She was unconscious in less than a minute, curled tightly around Pantalaimon. But Will couldn't find sleep, no matter how long he lay there. It was partly his hand, which was now throbbing right up to the elbow and uncomfortably swollen, and partly the hard ground, and partly the cold, and partly utter exhaustion, and partly his longing for his mother. He was afraid for her, of course, and he knew she'd be safer if he was there to look after her. But he wanted her to look after him, too, as she'd done when he was very small. He wanted her to bandage him, and tuck him into bed, and sing to him, and take away all the trouble, and surround him with all the warmth and softness and mother-kindness he needed so badly. And it was never going to happen. Part of him was only a little boy still. So he cried, but he lay very still as he did, not wanting to wake Lyra. But he still wasn't asleep. He was more awake than ever. Finally he uncurled his stiff limbs and got up quietly, shivering, and with a knife at his waist he set off higher up the mountain to calm his restlessness. Behind him the sentry witch's Robin demon cocked his head, and she turned from the watch she was keeping to see Will clambering up the rocks. She reached for her pine branch and silently took to the air, not to disturb him, but to see that he came to no harm. He didn't notice. He felt such a need to move and keep moving that he hardly noticed the pain in his hand any more. He felt as if he should walk all night, all day, forever, because nothing else would calm this fever in his breast. And as if in sympathy with him, a wind was rising. There were no leaves to stir in this wilderness, but the air buffeted his body and made his hair stream away from his face. It was wild outside him and wild within. He climbed higher and higher, hardly once thinking of how he might find his way back down to Lyra, until he came out on a little plateau almost at the top of the world, it seemed. All around him, on every horizon, the mountains reached no higher. In the brilliant glare of the moon, the only colours were stark black and dead white, and every edge was jagged and every surface bare. The wild wind must have been bringing clouds overhead, because suddenly the moon was covered, and darkness swept over the whole landscape. Thick clouds, too, for no gleam of moonlight shone through them. In less than a minute, Will found himself in nearly total darkness. And at the same moment, Will felt a grip on his right arm. He cried out with shock and twisted away at once, but the grip was tenacious. And Will was savage now. He felt he was at the very end of everything. And if it was the end of his life, too, he was going to fight and fight till he fell. So he twisted and kicked and twisted again, but that hand wouldn't let go. And since it was his right arm being held, he couldn't get at the knife. He tried with his left, but he was being jerked around so much, and his hand was so painful and swollen that he couldn't reach. He had to fight with one bare, wounded hand against a grown man. He sank his teeth into the hand on his forearm, but all that happened was that the man landed a dizzying blow on the back of his head. Then Will kicked again and again, and some of the kicks connected and some didn't, and all the time he was pulling, jerking, twisting, shoving, and still the grip held him fast. Dimly he heard his own panting and the man's grunts and harsh breathing, and then by chance he got his leg behind the man's and hurled himself against his chest, and the man fell with Will on top of him, heavily. But never for a moment did that grip slacken, and Will, Rolling around violently on the stony ground, felt a heavy fear tighten around his heart. This man would never let him go, and even if he killed him, his corpse would still be holding fast. But Will was weakening, and now he was crying too, sobbing bitterly as he kicked and tugged and beat at the man with his head and feet, and he knew his muscles would give up soon. And then he noticed that the man had fallen still, though his hand still gripped as tight as ever. He was lying there letting Will batter at him with knees and head, and as soon as Will saw that, the last of his strength left him, and he fell helpless beside his opponent, every nerve in his body ringing and dizzy and throbbing. Will hauled himself up painfully, peered through the deep darkness, and made out a blur of white on the ground beside the man. It was the white breast and head of a great bird, an osprey, a demon, and it was lying still. Will tried to pull away, and his feeble tug woke a response from the man, whose hand hadn't loosened. But he was moving. He was feeling Will's right hand carefully with his free one. Will's hair stood on end. Then the man said,
"Give me your other hand."
"Be careful."
The man's free hand felt down Will's left arm, and his fingertips moved gently over the wrist and onto the swollen palm and with the utmost delicacy onto the stumps of Will's two lost fingers. His other hand let go at once, and he sat up.
"You've got the knife. You're the knife-bearer."
His voice was resonant, harsh, but breathless. Will sensed that he was badly hurt. Had he wounded this dark opponent? Will was still lying on the stones, utterly spent. All he could see was the man's shape crouching above him, but he couldn't see his face. The man was reaching sideways for something, and after a few moments a marvelous, soothing coolness spread into his hand from the stumps of his fingers as the man massaged a salve into his skin.
"What are you doing?"
"Curing your wound. Keep still."
"Who are you?"
"I'm the only man who knows what the knife is for. Hold your hand up like that. Don't move."
The wind was beating more wildly than ever, and a drop or two of rain splashed onto Will's face. He was trembling violently, but he propped up his left hand with his right while the man spread more ointment over the stumps and wound a strip of linen tightly around the hand. And as soon as the dressing was secure, the man slumped sideways and lay down himself. Will, still bemused by the blessed cool numbness in his hand, tried to sit up and look at him. But it was darker than ever. He felt forward with his right hand and found himself touching the man's chest, where the heart was beating like a bird against the bars of a cage.
"Yes. Try and cure that. Go on."
"You will."
"I'll be better soon. You have the knife, yes?"
"Yes."
"And you know how to use it?"
"Yes. Yes, but are you from this world? How do you know about it?"
"Listen,"
said the man, sitting up with a struggle.
"Don't interrupt. If you're the bearer of the knife, you have a task that's greater than you can imagine. A child. How could they let it happen? Well, so it must be. There is a war coming, boy. The greatest war there ever was. Something like it happened before, and this time the right side must win. We've had nothing but lies and propaganda and cruelty and deceit for all the thousands of years of human history. It's time we started again, but properly this time."
He stopped to take in several rattling breaths.
"The knife,"
he went on after a minute.
"They never knew what they were making, those old philosophers. They invented a device that could split open the very smallest particles of matter, and they used it to steal candy. They had no idea that they'd made the one weapon in all the universes that could defeat the tyrant, the authority, God. The rebel angels fell because they didn't have anything like the knife. But now..."
"I didn't want it. I don't want it now. If you want it, you can have it. I hate it, and I hate what it does."
"Too late. You haven't any choice. You're the bearer. It's picked you out. And what's more, they know you've got it. And if you don't use it against them, they'll tear it from your hands and use it against the rest of us forever and ever."
"But why should I fight them? I've been fighting too much. I can't go on fighting. I want to..."
"Have you won your fights?"
Will was silent. Then he said,
"Yes, I suppose."
"You fought for the knife."
"Yes, but..."
"Then you're a warrior. That's what you are. Argue with anything else, but don't argue with your own nature."
Will knew that the man was speaking the truth. But it wasn't a welcome truth. It was heavy and painful. The man seemed to know that because he let Will bow his head before he spoke again.
"There are two great powers. And they've been fighting since time began. Every advance in human life, every scrap of knowledge and wisdom and decency we have, has been torn by one side from the teeth of the other. Every little increase in human freedom has been fought over ferociously between those who want us to know more and be wiser and stronger, and those who want us to obey and be humble and submit. And now, those two powers are lining up for battle. And each of them wants that knife of yours more than anything else. You have to choose, boy. We've been guided here, both of us. You with the knife, and me to tell you about it.
No, you're wrong. I wasn't looking for anything like that. That's not what I was looking for at all.
You might not think so, but that's what you found.
But what must I do?
And then Stanislaus Krumman, John Parry, hesitated. He was painfully aware of the oath he'd sworn to Lee Scoresby, and he hesitated before he broke it. But break it he did.
You must go to Lord Asriel and tell him that Stanislaus Krumman sent you, and that you have the one weapon he needs above all others. Like it or not, boy, you have a job to do. Ignore everything else, no matter how important it seems, and go and do this. Someone will appear to guide you. The night is full of angels. Your wound will heal now. Wait. Before you go, I want to look at you properly.
He felt for the pack he'd been carrying and took something out, unfolding layers of oilskin and then striking a match to light a little tin lantern. In its light, through the rain-dashed windy air, the two looked at each other. Will saw blazing blue eyes and a haggard face with several days' growth of beard on the stubborn jaw, grey-haired, drawn with pain, a thin body hunched in a heavy cloak trimmed with feathers. The shaman saw a boy even younger than he'd thought, his slim body shivering in a torn linen shirt, and his expression exhausted and savage and weary, but alight with a wild curiosity, his eyes wide under the straight black brows, so like his mother's. And there came just the first flicker of something else to both of them. But in that same moment, as the lantern light flared over John Parry's face, something shot down from the turbid sky, and he fell back dead before he could say a word, an arrow in his failing heart. The osprey demon vanished in a moment. Will could only sit stupefied. A flicker crossed the corner of his vision, and his right hand darted up at once, and he found he was clutching a robin, a demon, red-breasted, panicking.
No! No!
Cried the witch Jutta Kamainen, and fell down after him, clutching at her own heart, crashing clumsily into the rocky ground and struggling up again. But Will was there before she could find her feet, and the subtle knife was at her throat.
Why did you do that? Why did you kill him?
Because I loved him and he scorned me. I am a witch. I don't forgive.
And because she was a witch, she wouldn't have been afraid of a boy normally. But she was afraid of Will. This young wounded figure held more force and danger than she'd ever met in a human before, and she quailed. She fell backwards and he followed and gripped her hair with his left hand, feeling no pain, feeling only an immense and shattering despair.
You don't know who he was. He was my father.
She shook her head and whispered,
No, no, that can't be true. Impossible.
You think things have to be possible. Things have to be true. He was my father, and neither of us knew it till the second you killed him. Witch, I wait all my life and come all this way, and I find him at last, and you kill him.
And he shook her head like a rag and threw her back against the ground, half stunning her. Her astonishment was almost greater than her fear of him, which was real enough. And she pulled herself up, dazed, and seized his shirt in supplication. He knocked her hand away.
What did he ever do that you needed to kill him? Tell me that if you can.
And she looked at the dead man. Then she looked back at Will and shook her head sadly.
No, I can't explain. You're too young. It wouldn't make sense to you. I loved him, that's all. That's enough.
And before Will could stop her, she fell softly sideways, her hand on the hilt of the knife she had just taken from her own belt and pushed between her ribs. Will felt no horror, only desolation and bafflement. He stood up slowly and looked down at the dead witch, at her rich black hair, her flushed cheeks, her smooth pale limbs wet with rain, her lips parted like a lover's.
I don't understand. It's too strange.
Will turned back to the dead man, his father. A thousand things jostled at his throat, and only the dashing rain cooled the hotness in his eyes. The little lantern still flickered and flared as the draught through the ill-fitting window licked around the flame, and by its light Will knelt and put his hands on the man's body, touching his face, his shoulders, his chest, closing his eyes, pushing the wet grey hair off his forehead, pressing his hands to the rough cheeks, closing his father's mouth, squeezing his hands.
Father? Dad? Daddy? Father, I don't understand why she did that. It's too strange for me. But whatever you wanted me to do, I promise, I swear I'll do it. I'll fight. I'll be a warrior. I will. This knife. I'll take it to Lord Asriel, wherever he is, and I'll help him fight that enemy. I'll do it. You can rest now. It's all right. You can sleep now.
Beside the dead man lay his deerskin pack with the oilskin and the lantern and the little horn box of blood moss ointment. Will picked them up, and then he noticed his father's feather-trimmed cloak trailing behind his body on the ground, heavy and sodden but warm. His father had no more use for it, and Will was shaking with cold. He unfastened the bronze buckle of the dead man's throat and swung the canvas pack over his shoulder before wrapping the cloak around himself. He blew out the lantern and looked back at the dim shapes of his father, of the witch, of his father again, before turning to go down the mountain. The stormy air was electric with whispers, and in the tearing of the wind Will could hear other sounds, too. Confused echoes of cries and chanting, the clash of metal on metal, pounding wing beats that one moment sounded so close they might actually be inside his head, and the next so far away they might have been on another planet. The rocks underfoot were slippery and loose, and it was much harder going down than it had been climbing up, but he didn't falter. And as he turned down the last little gully before the place where he'd left Lyra sleeping, he stopped suddenly. He could see two figures simply standing there in the dark, waiting. Will put his hand on the knife. Then one of the figures spoke.
"You're the boy with the knife," he said,
and his voice had the strange quality of those wing beats. Whoever he wasn't a human being.
"Who are you? Are you men or..."
"Not men, no. We are watchers. Bene Elim. In your language, angels."
Will was silent. The speaker went on.
"Other angels have other functions and other powers. Our task is simple. We need you. We have been following the shaman every inch of his way, hoping he would lead us to you, and so he has. And now we have come to guide you in turn to Lord Asriel."
"You were with my father all the time?"
"Every moment."
"Did he know?"
"He had no idea."
"Why didn't you stop the witch then? Why did you let her kill him?"
"We would have done, earlier. But his task was over once he'd led us to you."
Will said nothing. His head was ringing. This was no less difficult to understand than anything else.
"All right,"
he said finally.
"I'll come with you. But first I must wake Lyra."
They stood aside to let him pass, and he felt a tingle in the air as he went close to them. But he ignored it and concentrated on getting down the slope toward the little shelter where Lyra was sleeping. But something made him stop. In the dimness he could see the witches who had been guarding Lyra all sitting or standing still. They looked like statues, except that they were breathing, but they were scarcely alive. There were several black silk-clad bodies on the ground, too, and as he gazed in horror from one to another of them, Will saw what must have happened. They had been attacked in mid-air by the specters, and had fallen to their deaths indifferently. But...
"Where's Lyra?"
The hollow under the rock was empty. Lyra was gone. There was something under the overhang where she'd been lying. It was Lyra's little canvas rucksack, and from the weight of it he knew without looking that the alethiometer was still inside it. Will was shaking his head. It couldn't be true, but it was. Lyra was gone. Lyra was captured. Lyra was lost. The two dark figures of the Bene Elim had not moved. But they spoke.
"You must come with us now. Lord Asriel needs you at once. The enemy's power is growing every minute. The shaman has told you what your task is. Follow us and help us win. Come with us. Come this way. Come now."
And Will looked from them to Lyra's rucksack and back again. And he didn't hear a word they said.
Thank you. That is the end of The Subtle Knife, written and narrated by Philip Pullman. The Subtle Knife is the second part of a trilogy called His Dark Materials. The first part was called The Golden Compass. The third part is called The Amber Spyglass. Featured in the cast were Joanna Wyatt as Lyra, Stephen Webb as Will, Julian Glover as Stanislaus Grumman, Susan Sheridan as Serafina Pecola, Stephen Thorne as Sir Charles Latram and Thorold, Alison Dowling as Mrs. Coulter, Paul Panting as Pantalaimon, Eve Karpf as Ruta Scardi, and Douglas Blackwell as Giacomo Paradisi. Garrick Hagen was Lee Scoresby, Tim Bentinck was Joachim Lorenz, and Kate Locke was Dr. Mary Malone. Heywood Morse played Fra Pavel and Oliver Payne, and Teresa Gallagher played Lena Felt and Jutta Kamainen. Gordon Reed was the archaeologist and Inspector Walters, and Stephen Greif was Martin Lancelius. Hester and Mrs. Parry were performed by Liza Ross, and Mrs. Cooper and the Tortured Witch by Anne Rosenfeld. Andrew Branch was Kaiser and Alan Perkins. William Roberts played Sam Cancino and Umak, and Nigel Carrington was the voice of the Angel. Emma D'Inverno played Angelica, Arthur Mitchell was Paolo, and the rest of the children were played by Thomas Grundy, Anna Colin, Andrew Lamont, and Fiona Lamont. Other parts were played by members of the cast. The executive producers of this recording were Bruce Colville, Timothy P. Ditlow, and Orly Moskowitz. It was recorded at the BBC Broadcasting House in London, England, where the engineer was Tim Sturgeon. Wolfgang Dienst was the post-production editor, and the music was composed by Peter Ponson. This has been a Story Circle production, directed by Garrick Hagen for Words Take Wing and Listening Library, an imprint of the Random House Audio Publishing Group. Copyright 2000, Random House Incorporated.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.